Okay, so my voice is still working, so we can have the last session, and I'll try my best to rest it overnight. So as I said, I thought it was best to mainly keep the recent subprime crisis to the last lecture, because obviously that will sustain your interest, I hope, but also it will enable us to apply the theories that we've talked about, as well as the policies, the experience, to this particular event and see how well they fit in, right? So that's the intention of the structure of today. What about the build-up to the crisis? Firstly, from a global point of view, I think we can argue that there were low real interest rates across the world from 2002 to 2007, and the long rates in particular were low because of China, Japan, etc., generating high saving and providing liquidity to the global capital markets. We all know that China is financing America, and obviously that means that the yield on US treasuries is lower than if China was not financing America, and that's true generally. On the other hand, the short rates were also held low, in particular in the US, following the dot-com bubble collapse from 2000 to 2002. It's easy to forget that that was quite a frightening experience at the time. We saw the biggest falls in equity markets since 1973-4, and there was also the 2001 attack on America. Various unpleasant things happened between 2000 and 2002, and therefore there seemed a good reason to hold monetary policy very loose in the wake of that. There was a widespread debt and asset price boom, and I'm emphasizing, we're going to talk about America more in a minute, but these are quite global things in many countries, and some features of the market that have not been stress tested. This is going back to our concept of uncertainty generated by innovations, and the new asset-backed securities were hiding risk rather than sharing or reducing it, and banks were very reliant on wholesale markets. So again, we come back to this thing. Banks wanted to grow loans or their balance sheet generally faster than customer deposits were providing them with funds. So they tried to go outside their customer deposit base, which was an unwise thing. I mean, the strangest thing about the asset-backed securities, which we'll talk about a bit more in a minute, is the way that everyone said securitization was going to improve the resilience of the financial system, because it will diffuse risk from banks to those best able to hold it. Well, what did it actually do? It ended up coming back onto banks' balance sheets as they held securities directly that other banks had issued, even though they knew from their own issues that these things were not very reliable, as well as into their subsidiaries, the conduits and sieves. So that is a very odd feature that can be explained, I'm afraid, by strategic reactions to capital adequacy requirements, for one thing, which didn't penalize the subsidiaries as much as they should have done, as well as the role of rating agencies that said that these things were AAA when they weren't. But let's start off by looking a bit more at some charts, which are quite fun. This is from the paper in the back by Ray Barrell and myself that we wrote at the end of last year on the subprime crisis. You can see here how the US real short rate was actually negative from 2002 to 2005, and equally the US long rate, due to China, etc., had a much lower level right through from 2002 to 2008 than it had in the late 1990s. So you can see illustrated there, especially for the US, I mean, the UK has similar patterns. You can see there how monetary conditions were easy, and there was a big attraction at the long end as well to borrow. And as we know, personal sector borrowing was very high. And again, I think this chart is helpful because it's easy to focus very much on the United States. But what we can see here is that borrowing was growing everywhere except in Germany over a long period, but especially during the early 2000s over here. And this chart is interesting to think about. Some of you are doing personal sector. And this long-term chart shows you two things, I think. Firstly, you've got financial liberalization. Financial liberalization took place around 1980. And what you can see for the UK, for example, is this what we call the stock adjustment to financial liberalization. So the argument was that the rise in debt through the 80s was an adjustment that was rational and sustainable to the fact that credit was freely available now. It did, in fact, overshoot, and during this period we had quite a lot of financial fragility, but of this period, especially early 90s. But there was a kind of argument that that was the sort of thing you would expect. And you can see it happening in America as well in the 1980s. Spain, of course, didn't liberalize, so for a long time they had a low debt rate. The French had a small attenuated pattern. The Germans didn't really change much. So that was the 1980s housing boom accompanied by rising debt. In the 90s, we saw the financial difficulties of the early 90s and things leveled off. Then, though, we had the reduction in inflation, the great, what was it called? The great stabilization? There's a word, isn't there?
Moderation.
Great?
Moderation.
The great moderation. Okay, so during the great moderation, the argument then was, well, people can afford to have more debt because the interest rate is going to be permanently lower. Okay, so that kicked off this second phase of rising debt in the late 1990s already. The argument that it's okay to lend people more than you used to because of permanently lower interest rates. And you can see that in the UK and the US. In Spain, meanwhile, there was financial liberalization and things were really taking off as well. And then, if you like, the final phase of this picture that has ended up to be ended in tears, if you like, is this final period when we've had these low interest rates, even lower than the Great Moderation, what we just saw. I mean, remember, this is the Great Moderation, when interest rates in real terms were around 4%. And then suddenly we've got this further moderation when they were suddenly halved. So it's not surprising that people went crazy borrowing in the UK and the US and Spain and various other countries as well. And I guess my understanding of most Eastern European countries and maybe Estonia is that you've seen a kind of transition, like this early transition, and the worry is, has it overshot or not? Yeah. Don't know if anyone wants to comment on that. Anyway, we'll talk further about that later. And what happened to real house prices in the meantime? Again, we can see a nice pattern here of this huge housing boom during the period of monetary easing from 2003 to 2007. And in the UK at least, we'd seen loads of housing booms. We saw a crash in the mid-70s, we saw another crash in the early 90s, and then we got this incredible boom from 1994 up to now. That had also been the case in France and in Spain. And the Germans, as always, are different from everybody else, and their house prices didn't go up at all. But the difference was that this time the Americans shared in the boom. And you can see historically, American housing prices have been much more stable than those in Europe. And that's part of the problem, I think, that eventually happened. What we believe was one problem with the CDOs, the collateralized debt obligations, is that they built in an assumption that nationwide US housing prices would never fall. You would only get regional falls, and they would be offset elsewhere. And you can see, in effect, the history almost backs that up, that nationwide American housing prices had been fairly flat over history. But as we see here, they were dead wrong about reality, and they could have known that by looking at any other country, because US housing prices peaked in 2006, and the reason why the subprime crisis started in mid-2007 is because the effects of that little that fall there were really starting to feed through. And we'll talk about that in a minute.
Sorry, are those prices of 1 square meter or of one house?
They're all national indices, so they may be standardized in different ways, but I think they try to mix adjust so that they're not just showing better housing. So in other words, they try to standardize in some way, like what you say, or in some other way. Okay, let's have a look at the build-up in the US. Basically, rush to subprime lending in the United States, which was encouraged by the government, and I only just found this. This is a radio address from President George Bush that I circulated on the Financial Stability Group, and it talked about the greatest single hurdle to first-time homeownership is a high down payment that can put a home out of reach. So my administration is proposing the American Dream Down Payment Fund. When a low-income household is qualified to buy a home but comes up short on the down payment, the American Dream Down Payment Fund will help provide the needed funds. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's illustrating how much the US government was supporting lending and encouraging lending to poor people who ultimately were at the root of the crisis. So let's get back here. Yeah, so rush to subprime lending, it was an area which had not been explored much. There was an implicit support by the government, and basically the whole private securitization system had been developed in order to finance it. In the US, as you may know, there are what we call government agencies who had been securitizing what we call prime housing loans for a long time. Okay, this is Fannie Mae, etc., and Freddie Mac. And prime housing loans had to meet certain criteria in order to be acceptable to be packaged into a government agency bond that would then be issued by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and that would then have a US government guarantee. Subprime lending was massively facilitated by the development of private securitization that really took off in the late 90s and early 2000s. In other words, it didn't have a government guarantee. It was issued by private institutions, but it involved clever forms of packaging of the cash flow streams in the securities that, as you may be aware of, they separated it into what they call tranches. So you'd have a high-risk tranche that would be equity that would take the initial losses, and then a mezzanine tranche that would take losses once the equity was wiped out. And then you would have a AAA tranche that was supposed to be low risk because it would only make a loss when the other two lots of tranches were wiped out. That's the basic structure of a collateralized debt obligation. And again, there's this beautiful chart that I need to show you, if I can find it, from Banque de France, that shows that basically these things were alchemy, right? They were making lead into gold. They were saying that a whole bunch of loans that were extremely high risk could somehow generate 70% of AAA rated securities. So that was pure alchemy, but it was supported by the rating agencies, who were willing to say that these things were AAA. So credit assessment was neglected, is all we can say there, for the CDOs and other ABSs. The banks were involved in asset growth. They wanted to grow their balance sheet. They didn't care about liquidity, and nor did the supervisors very much. And the ABSs, as we said, some of them are held in these subsidiaries called SIVs and conduits. Others, on the other hand, and which were under Basel I, were lightly treated for capital. And that would be financed by asset-backed commercial paper. The banks, on the other hand, would provide the backup for the asset-backed commercial paper program. And others, as I said earlier, would just be held on balance sheet. And a lot of them went over to Europe, of course. Context of the global liquidity glut and the search for yield. Because the long-term interest rate was so low, thanks to the Chinese, you had all these institutions out there desperate to provide sufficient yield to keep the customers happy. So anything high risk was going to look attractive. Suspicion of disaster myopia. Well, at least Nouriel Roubini foresaw it, as I said earlier. And the interesting puzzle is, well, why didn't the insurance companies and the pension funds buy all this stuff rather than the banks and subsidiaries and the banks themselves? And I think one argument is that the regulation applied to insurance companies and pension funds was actually inappropriate. This is an argument made by the Warwick Commission, who've done a very interesting report on macroprudential, which is worth a look. It's been circulated on the Financial Stability Group. They argue that regulation of insurance companies has become very much like regulation of banks, despite the fact that these sorts of institutions don't have the liquidity risk of banks. And that has discouraged them from holding this stuff, while banks in turn have been incentivized to. So that's an interesting point. I would argue that the subprime crisis can be divided between a non-systemic and a systemic period, and this is not fixed in a sense, you know. There were plenty of systemic worries even before Lehman's collapsed, but I think we can still argue that Lehman's was like a watershed after which it was clearly systemic, right? So that's an artificial division, but I'm going to make it anyway. And what I think we can argue is that we had two aspects of the crisis from the point of view of systemic risk. And the first one is market liquidity risk. Basically, we saw about the US housing market turning down. So subprime started to generate losses, even in 2006 and early 2007, because the value of houses went below the mortgage. And as you may know, in America, you're allowed to just post the keys through the real estate agent's door and you're freed of the debt. This is what we call non-recourse mortgages. In Europe, or at least in Britain, you don't have non-recourse mortgages. If you do that, they can chase you until eternity for the money. In America, you're out of it as soon as you put the key through the door. Okay? So it's much easier to default in America than in England. And probably in the rest of Europe as well. So that led to worries about what the asset-backed securities like the CDOs were worth, leading on to sales of them. And because they weren't very liquid markets in the first place, you got the same market liquidity failure as in Russia LTCM. There was no trading anymore, and the prices just fell through the floor. And you were unable to unload them anyway in any quantity. Price falls, lower risk appetite, not just credit risk. And there are interesting charts, as I say, which show how bank losses have been 40% due to liquidity risk and only 60% due to credit risk. And that's this sort of thing. Aggravated by the sort of margin requirements and credit limits on people who would otherwise take positions to stabilize, and also the market makers didn't have much appetite to hold this stuff either. I mean, if you're a market maker in the CDO market, what would happen to you is that you would have lots of people wanting to sell and no one wanting to buy, right? So what do? You don't answer the phone. Simple as that. the rush to sell was worsened by the mark-to-market's impact. That's to do with the, as I say, the liquidity risk as well as the credit risk that directly hit solvency, whereas in past crises, it's always been the credit risk, but not the liquidity risk as well, not the fall in prices, in other words, of these assets. And the contagion spread via the asset-backed commercial paper. No one wanted to buy the stuff anymore that was financing the subsidiaries of the banks. So when they needed refinancing, they had to be taken back onto the bank's balance sheet, as well as traders' attempts to hedge, meet margin calls, realize gains. And a great source, if you want to go into the sort of microstructure of the subprime crisis, is the IMF's Global Capital Markets Report. I think they're very perceptive. And the pattern was an interaction between market liquidity risk and funding risk. And the funding risk is obviously our old friend, the wholesale market borrowing that the banks were doing. And what happened there, as we may know, is that banks were unable to securitize their loans, so they were piling up these mortgages, what we call warehouse risk. The conduits and SIVs were calling for backup lines of credit. Banks were worried about other banks' solvency because of the worry about toxic assets. So that helps to explain the collapse of the, or the partial collapse of the interbank market during that time. And we've never seen the interbank market collapse in countries like the US, UK, or continental Europe before. This was something that happens to far-flung emerging market economies that had gone too far into the international interbank market. It wasn't supposed to happen in advanced countries, but it did. So because the interbank market became, let's say, at least unreliable, banks started to hoard liquidity. And there was widespread quantity rationing in the interbank market. Then in September, we had the collapse of Northern Rock, which, as far as its balance sheet goes, was actually solvent, although it had some silly mortgages up to 125% LTV. But the basic problem was it was so reliant on wholesale funding and on securitization that it suddenly collapsed. So the collapse was part of that, then Bear Stearns in February, and eventually Lehman's, which started the systemic phase. And I think, as I say, a close relation between the funding risk and the market liquidity risk. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. And then if we go on to the systemic period, the failure of Lehman's, which you'll remember, I'm sure, with some trepidation, basically led to all hell breaking loose. The wholesale markets dried up altogether, including commercial paper. I talked earlier about the money market funds. They might have invested in Lehman's, or at least they were invested in devaluing assets. They broke the dollar. There was a customer run on the American money market funds. They then, as well as people selling mutual fund and hedge fund units. That meant that all these institutional investors were dumping assets on the illiquid markets because they had to. If you're a mutual fund and someone wants their money, you have to sell the assets. It doesn't matter what the price is, they'll just get the low price. But that aggravated the cycle after Lehman's, and I think these aspects are not appreciated very much, so it's worth bearing those in mind. Flight to quality, again like Russia LTCM, and we had lots of bank failures in the wake of that. We had Fortis, you'll remember, and various banks in different countries, and those that didn't fail had to be recapitalized in many cases. The crisis spread onto the real economy. Bernanke talked about the adverse feedback loop, and we've certainly ended with a major recession, I understand. In your country, it's what's GDP's fallen by 14%, is that right? Something like that. And you're an innocent bystander, so hopefully. Iceland was not an innocent bystander. I don't think I didn't see many Estonian banks offering high interest rates in the UK like the Icelanders did. Okay, particular US problems. I think this number's way out of date, but that was an earlier estimate of the losses. This reminds us that a lot went to Europe. The subprime loans had defaults that are very high because the bankruptcy law that I just mentioned, non-recourse. The unwise lending was masked by the securitization model, and the securities were evaluated on individual basis, but also, as I said, it was based on the idea that there was some sort of diversification that was quite solid if you held loans across the US. Yeah, there was this assumption built in that US house prices would not fall over the country as a whole. And that shows us credit spreads and shows us the extreme extent of what actually happened. What you can see here is the long-term pattern is quite interesting as well. You can see here how these are credit quality spreads, okay? Long-term credit quality spreads between BAA corporate and government. What you can see is that the credit quality spread had got very low from about 2004 to 2007. And that's part of the pattern. So we're adding this, remember, to the government bond yield in order to get a non-government lending rate at a fairly low yield, a fairly low rating. And what it's saying is that you could issue BAA bonds for a long time at less than 2% above government in all three markets. And I think historically that's very low. So this is an additional point to the Chinese, Asian pressure downwards on long-term rates generally. This is the rise in risk appetite that's being illustrated here. Basically, people were willing to take a lower price for credit risk. Admittedly, this was quite a turbulent period, but I think if you go back to the 90s, it's still not as low as this. And then it illustrates the two phases of the crisis. First, August 2007, which you'll remember were triggered by things like Paribas withdrawing various mutual funds, etc. We thought that was bad at the time, but then things really took off in October 2008, and much worse, interestingly, in the UK and the Eurozone than even in the US. This chart is really important from various points of view. What I'll be saying later is that the credit quality spread is an important determinant of fixed investment, right? Because it's showing us how much corporates have to pay up compared to governments for any form of debt. And the rise in the corporate spread has helped to generate a big loss of fixed capital that will have a permanent adverse effect on the economies. It's also showing the difficulties that the banks were in because they would have to pay this as well. But it's a nice chart, I think, to illustrate the crisis. Okay, so you know this already to some extent, what I've said, but I think it's useful to repeat it. What we're now going to do in the rest of the time is to look back at some of the things we've been talking about today and see how they fit in with the subprime crisis. And firstly, thinking about theory, we talked about financial fragility and the credit cycle. The crisis was clearly linked to an asset price bubble in US housing especially, but elsewhere. Also fueled by underpriced credit, people were through the system providing credit to subprime at much too low an interest rate. And often this was done in a potentially deceptive way, in my view, by offering the subprime borrowers what they call teaser rates, very low interest rates to kick off with, and then rising later, which was actually a trigger for default very often. There came a moment when the situation seemed unsustainable. This is what we call a Minsky moment. And it's interesting that although Lehman's was clearly the adverse shock that generated the systemic period, the non-systemic period, it was harder to see exactly what caused August 2007. As I say, Paribas withdrew some mutual funds, but it didn't seem in line with the idea of a serious adverse shock. But anyway, we did get a tightening of credit, asset price falls, and bank failures, so that's pretty much validated, I think. The monetarist theory, one might highlight the inappropriate monetary policy from 2002 to 2004, that it was kept easy too long in the United States. There was a tightening up to 2006, which in the end helped to cause the downturn in the housing market and helped trigger the crisis. I think the regime shift as well that really shocked the authorities was this closure of the wholesale markets that had never been seen before. That was something that the market as well found very hard to cope with. In terms of the uncertainty theory, again we're talking about lecture one here, the financial innovations we had were very opaque, they were hard to see through, they'd never been tested in a downturn. Disaster myopia, not seeing the crisis coming. Institutions and most policymakers basically were very happy in the boom period. My colleague Dilly Karim and I have looked at the last reports of the macroprudential analysts from IMF, Bank of England, BIS, and European Central Bank in 2007, just before the crisis. And although they were all sort of a little bit uneasy, none of them said, let's really be careful now. The BIS, who I think were the most accurate. The BIS have always been a very good one to watch, and I would always recommend people to read the BIS annual report as perhaps the most thoughtful piece of commentary. But yeah, I think we have to say that most common policymakers missed it as well, and in particular governments were congratulating themselves on how wonderful the job they were doing. Because everyone was so happy with all these rising house prices and rising debt and all this wonderful tax revenue that was coming from this financial activity as well. Certainly in the UK, my colleagues and I at the National Institute, or my colleagues especially, have argued that the UK allowed the cyclically adjusted fiscal position to become very, very loose in the run-up to the crisis. They weren't taking advantage of the boom to pay back government debt, which is what they should have done. They were using it all to boost public expenditure. And that's why the UK is in a much bigger fiscal mess than virtually anyone else. But we're not alone, I don't think. Disaster myopia, and two announcements, as we said earlier, BNP Paribas and then Lehman's made a sharp adjustment of subjective risk perceptions back to what was objective, if you like. Risk aversion rebounded in 2007, but then far, far more in 2008. So disaster myopia we can see there as well. Agency costs points, the incentives to underprice risk in these securitized assets is huge. As I said earlier, there are lots of principal agent gaps, and all of them generated further mispricing, in my view. The opacity is a key aspect, but also the failure of the credit rating agencies. And it also, we can understand the collapse of the interbank market and other wholesale markets because of agency costs and uncertainty there as well. On the industrial point of view, new players were able to enter the various markets, in particular the agents going around soliciting subprime loans. They were new entrants. They didn't know anything about market dynamics. They were just told to sell as many mortgages as they could. And so that worsened the adverse selection that is at the heart of the crisis. But also new players in investment, hedge funds, SIVs and conduits, were perhaps less aware of risk than they should have been. The banks themselves were providing new forms of finance. The credit, the hedge funds, later short selling and forced sales were central to the crisis as well. And again, that's something that's perhaps not so much focused on. So that, if you like, is the first part, which is saying, well, what about the theories? Can we link them in? And if you look at the paper I mentioned earlier by myself and Dilly Karim, we go through that stuff in a slightly more detail. What about the indicators? You remember I had the various generic features of crises. In terms of regime shift to laxity, we've got US monetary policy as a favorable shock, the easing that facilitated all the borrowing, as well as the Asian savings surplus. New entry, the subprime lenders, debt accumulation in the subprime. Asset price boom in the US housing, although as we've seen, it's a feature elsewhere, Spain, Ireland, UK, Iceland, some of the Eastern Europeans as well, Estonia. Various innovations, the CDOs and SIVs, underpricing of risk, etc. The use of SIVs meant that capital adequacy in the end was not an accurate risk indication because the banks had these implicit liabilities that were not being captured by Basel I. Incorrect ratings, again, meant capital adequacy was not showing risk in the way it should have done. And those are the sorts of reasons why I think we should have a leverage ratio and not just a risk-adjusted capital adequacy. We should have both to try to capture those things in the future, as well as much better accounting for those kinds of subsidiaries. Regime shift to rigor, or adverse shock, I suppose it's really the house price weakening. The other stuff, as I say, is fairly obvious. Credit rationing in the interbank market, wholesale money markets, mortgage market, later all forms of private credit, and today it applies to some governments as well. Everyone's worried about Greece, for example. Maybe that worry will ease, or maybe it will spread to others. We've had Dubai. Operation of the safety net, lender of last resort, Northern Rock, bear stearns, but not layman's. But we're going to talk about that in a minute. Any questions? Okay, let's have a look at the incentive problems. So that's lecture two in respect to the subprime. Adverse selection, we've got the loan officers who let the credit risk accumulate. They lent to the people they shouldn't have lent to, so plenty of that. The interbank market collapse, again, related to adverse selection. What banks feared was that the banks they would borrow from, they would lend to, are the ones with the toxic assets. So they didn't lend to anybody. Moral hazard in terms of the subsidiaries again, which was passing on the risk to the safety net. Incentive of the originators not to monitor as well as adversely to select. Incentive of the rating agencies to give the top ratings to the CDOs, partly because the issuer had to pay. There's another interesting argument about rating agencies that the mistake, it's been argued, has been that they were told to disclose everything about how they did ratings, right, in the early 2000s. rather than just letting them get on with it. They were told you have to disclose everything. And because they have to disclose everything about how to do a rating, that enabled the banks to tailor the products to the methodology of the rating agency, right? If the rating agencies had not been told in the first place to say exactly how they did a rating, that tailoring wouldn't have been possible, right? So that's an interesting one, because that suggests the regulators are, it's not just the rating agency's fault. I just read that a few days ago. Incentive of UK retail depositors to run on Northern Rock, and that was linked, we talked about earlier, to deposit insurance, because the UK was taking on the EU standard, more or less, of deposit insurance, which was only 90% coverage, and it was 30,000, I think, at the time, which was probably a bit low compared with a lot of deposits. Interestingly, the UK, I think, already had said they would cover everything, but then the run carried on because people feared a delay. You know, they didn't even want a delay, which is kind of understandable. So Northern Rock at least shows that co-insurance is probably not the best way to do it. Lenders in the wholesale market have the incentive to avoid their counterparty risks and hoard liquidity. So we had the runs on Northern Rock, Bear Stearns and Lehman's, for example. And we also had the runs that we didn't really know about from HBOS and RBS. This is a possible one, that whether the regulators informed the central banks early enough about the liquidity problems. Some debate in the UK whether that happened, which may show that it's better in the central bank. It's an interesting argument. Adverse selection, moral hazard incentives for credit rationing, firstly in the interbank, later in the real economy. And finally, that if you like, what Lehman's did was it meant that the confidence that the market had in the too big to fail, they thought, you know, anything will be rescued so long as it's big. Lehman showed that wasn't the case, and then we saw what happened when they ceased to believe that. Not saying that was a good thing or a bad thing, it's just part of the explanation, I think. You know, should Lehman's have been rescued is an interesting question. If it had been rescued, maybe the thing wouldn't have been quite so bad, but the opposite argument is moral hazard would have been much worse, something big would have collapsed eventually. So, any comments at this point or questions? Okay. Most of the rest of the lecture is about crisis resolution, and in particular, lender of last resort, based on my earlier paper. So, what we're going to talk about is how the subprime crisis has really changed the situation for lender of last resort. And what's argued here is that there are a number of challenges to those doing the safety net. Firstly, dealing with this interaction of funding liquidity and market liquidity. We weren't traditional lender of last resort that we talked about earlier is pretty much to do with funding risk. It's saying, well, we have to help banks that are short of liquidity because no one wants to fund them. Market liquidity to some extent, but not that crucial. But in this crisis, they clearly interacted with each other, and partly because funding was in markets that had become illiquid, if you see what I mean. It wasn't just people didn't want to lend, it was also that the liquidity generally was not there. New responses, they had to support non-banks, for example, take lower quality collateral and longer maturities. And new challenges like the confidentiality issue and stigma that was revealed by Northern Rock, interaction with deposit insurance as well. And then coping with the systemic crisis, finally. And I think the argument is that we need to supplement this different kinds of risk, and also think about mark-to-market as an important aspect of it as well. Okay, so the first thing I want to do then is to talk about some academic work that has been done, which is relevant, I think, to thinking about the crisis, because that helps us to understand what the challenges facing the authorities were. And people like Tirole, I'm going to put his name there, French economist, have said, well, it wasn't that different, because look at these features that had always happened in most crises. Firstly, an asset price fall leading to a liquidity shock, that the house prices fell and eventually people were unwilling to finance the underlying assets. Deterioration of loan quality had always happened, and when we had runs, then there were fire sales of assets which worsened the problem. But I think there are some new aspects, or rather to some extent new, and as I said earlier, I talked myself about how market liquidity risk is like a bank run but in a market, and when I looked I found that Bernardo and Welsh had come to the same sort of conclusions but in a more rigorous way, so I'm just summarising what they say together with what I say on that. The argument here is, as I said earlier on, is that we think of a bank run in a debt market, but if you think the liquidity in the market is going to collapse, then you try and sell early. So if you think CDOs are going to become illiquid, you better sell your CDOs quickly. And obviously that becomes self-fulfilling, because if everyone is selling, then the market becomes illiquid anyway. So it's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, an endogenous risk, market liquidity risk. Markets stay liquid when some people think everything's fine, they buy the asset, some people think everything's bad, they sell. Everyone sells, the thing gets illiquid. And that has externalities similar to bank failures, is my argument, that people have to do fire sales of their securities in falling markets or in illiquid markets, like the mutual funds did after Lehman's. There are funding problems if you need to fund yourself in that market, and you get contagion to other markets. We have the ABS first, then the ABCP, then the interbank, and then everything else, except government bonds, more or less. And role of market makers is important in that context, and this relies on earlier work by Gloston and Milgram and others. That market makers who take on portfolios of assets in order to be available for people who want to buy, and will buy assets from people who sell, will not want to operate in situations either of uncertainty or asymmetric information. What do I mean by that? In terms of uncertainty, I mean if you don't really know what the valuation of these things are, you don't want to buy them. So that's the effect, that's the aspect of the asset-backed securities. But equally, they thought there was asymmetric information because they didn't really trust the counterparties either. So both those aspects meant no one really wanted to carry on with the market functioning. Dealers' capital would rapidly disappear as well if they had portfolios of devaluing assets, which was true in 2007. So eventually asset markets collapse, and that's what we saw for primary securitization, as well as later on all sorts of other markets. So that sort of theory seems quite a useful one, and I would recommend a look at Bernardo and Welsh. I would also recommend a look at Adrian and Shin. I think the references are not in this paper, but they are in the papers that I wrote on Lender of Last Resort. Adrian and Shin talk about contagion via asset price changes in a context of mark-to-market. So this is a nice bit of theory looking at the subprime crisis in particular, but making general comments about the behavior of banks. And their starting point is that increasingly commercial banks were trying to behave like investment banks. And what that meant was commercial banks, like investment banks, would have what they call active balance sheet management. They would have a positive relationship of leverage and balance sheet size. So in a good time, they would try and grow the balance sheet and allow leverage to increase as well. And leverage is not a good term in banking because people talk about leverage, they mean unweighted capital adequacy. So in that context, a rising leverage means a fall in leverage. Okay, so what we mean here by leverage is corporate finance leverage. In other words, something risky, okay? You see what I mean? The term leverage should be eliminated, although I've used it already, from discussion of banking supervision. We should talk about unweighted capital adequacy, okay? That's what when people talk about leverage ratios for banks, they should mean unweighted capital adequacy, okay? What we should use the word leverage for is what it's always meant, which is more debt relative to equity. And that's what we're talking about here. So what they're saying is that banks would build up their balance sheet size and increase their leverage, that they would have less capital for the size of the balance sheet. And in an upturn, that would boost liquidity. And what they do in their article is that they trace quite an interesting kind of relationship that's positive between balance sheet growth and leverage. And what they showed was that in early 1998, for example, they were right up here. Then we had the Russia LTCM crisis, and they went right down here. And the Russia LTCM crisis was quite a nasty period, but in the end, there was an adjustment, and we lost a hedge fund, and it cost a certain amount, but we didn't lose the financial system. What Adrian and Shin argue is that banks wanted to make a similar adjustment in 2007 and 2008, but they couldn't because of the obligations they had to backup lines of credit, okay? So the backup lines of credit were suddenly being called on their subsidiaries, the SIVs and conduits, meaning that asset growth was being kept up here. So their argument is, well, what did they do? They cut back on the only thing they could cut back on, and that was interbank. So they're saying that the desired reduction in balance sheet growth and leverage was done by eliminating interbank lending. It's an interesting argument. Freitas et al. Talk about interbank funding liquidity, quite a nice model of that. And their model seems pretty validated. The imperfect information on market tension can lead to even solvent banks having shortage of funds, and hoarding of liquidity leads in turn to bank runs. So that was pretty much what we saw. And then Brunnemeyer had looked at various kinds of what he calls amplifying mechanisms of liquidity shocks. And he talked about four different amplifying mechanisms that we could detect in the subprime crisis. Firstly, what he called borrower's balance sheet effects. So for example, you would make an initial loss on a leveraged balance sheet because ABS prices go down, say. That then reduces net worth. And by the way, it's important to note that this thing matters because of mark-to-market, right? It's the mark-to-market that generates the losses and forces the reduction over there. Equally, mark-to-market's relevant here. In the loss spiral, you get a decline in net worth because of falling asset prices, you sell some assets, but that accelerates the fall in asset prices. That lowers the net worth further, so that's what they call the loss spiral. The margin spiral, on the other hand, says that you get increased requirements of margins, the amount you have to put up when you buy an asset with credit. If you have more higher requirements of margin, you sell other assets to pay your margin. That generates lower prices. That requires higher margins because the people taking on the assets as repos or whatever are worried about their own losses, etc., etc. So Brunnemeyer is a really interesting paper. Again, I would read that. You'll put it a lot better than I have. In lending channel, the hoarding of liquidity we've talked about for precautionary reasons runs on institutions and markets. Again, we know. Network effects is quite interesting. What he says is that the reason Bear Stearns collapsed was partly because of Goldman Sachs. His argument is that Goldman Sachs expressed concern about its own exposures to Bear Stearns in the swap netting, in early 2008, just before Bear Stearns collapsed. And that in turn led hedge funds to avoid Bear Stearns because of what Goldman Sachs had said. And maybe they got more business as a consequence. And that in turn meant that Bear Stearns wasn't getting the business that was otherwise have supported it through the difficulty. And that led on to Bear Stearns' collapse. That's his argument, anyway. Okay, so let's look now, and we're nearly at the end, to lender of last resort in the subprime period. And again, I'm dividing it into the systemic and non-systemic periods. We're talking now about 2007-08 first. And I think this was the period when there was most innovation in terms of LOLR, partly because the fiscal authorities weren't really on the scene at that point. Not till Lehman's did they really come on the scene. So the central banks were kind of on their own. Firstly, what did they do? They tended to do open market operations, and they made longer maturities. In a sense, what they had to do was supplement the contraction of lending that the wholesale markets were generating. And in the end, and that's still true now, I think, the central banks are having to do the interbank markets business for it, almost. That's a new thing, then, the longer maturities. It was quite a protracted crisis. The question is, why didn't it finish? Was it a fear that the NCBs lacked the instruments, national central banks? A huge innovation was covering investment banks. That had not happened before. Bear Stearns, until it actually collapsed, was supported by the Fed. And what eventually happened, as I think you'll remember, is that it got bought by JP Morgan, didn't it?
Yeah.
So it didn't collapse in the way that Lehman's did, thanks to the Fed's support. And so what that was showing was that investment banks were now crucial to the financial system, and they were eligible for LOLR, which the Fed had never said was the case before. And they didn't regulate them. I'm going through it thematically like I did before. What about the costs of lender of last resort? It's a question of thinking through what lending to reliquify markets really is. Is it ambiguous or not? If the market is being definitively supported, then you can argue there's some kind of moral hazard there. Obviously, it does help the institutions to maintain their solvency. Issue of potential conflicts with other policies. Need to sterilize, or at least need to do something offsetting if you want to keep your monetary stance constant. So that was one issue. I go into that in detail in the paper. And also, how did you interpret the monetary stance? Because you saw that chart we had on the BAA government spread. perhaps the better known chart is the one on the LIBOR versus central bank intervention rate spread, yeah? Which you'll remember leapt up in 2007 and stayed up. So, whereas before banks had virtually always been able to borrow pretty much at the central bank rate, suddenly there was this spread, as you'll remember, between LIBOR, the interbank rate, and the central bank rate. And that's what I mean by how do you interpret the monetary stance if everyone else is borrowing at the central bank rate anyway? And issue how much moral hazard is generated by things like longer maturities, lending to investment banks, etc. Minimizing costs was not a concern in the sense that collateral standards were reduced, not in the Eurozone, because already, as you know, in the Eurozone, virtually anything can be used for collateral. But in the UK and the US, they had to reduce the standards. It used to be sort of government debt, etc. They became willing to lend on asset-backed securities as well, which would never have been thought of before. The central bank, in a sense, it was argued, was becoming lender of first resort, which was kind of worrying from the moral hazard point of view. And I think it's well known that in the Eurozone, banks have for some time now been making asset-backed security issues solely for the purpose of collateralizing their borrowing from the ECB, which the ECB is not particularly happy about. Private sector solutions, you'll remember, as you're supposed to look for private sector solutions. There was a desperate search in the case of Northern Rock, but no one really wanted Northern Rock except on an unacceptable basis. It worked for Bear Stearns, but only with a guarantee, sale to JP Morgan. And why is that? Partly because of the uncertainty on the valuation of those firms. You're supposed to have adequate information. It's not clear the Bank of England had that adequate information for Northern Rock. Did the FSA really warn them sufficiently? In the Northern Rock case, some interesting problems for LOLR, but the knowledge that it existed helped generate the retail run. Everyone thought the game's up, we'd better get our money out. So, leakage of information plus overt lending was something that clearly didn't necessarily work, although traditionally knowledge that the central bank is helping is supposed to calm the market. So that shows how difficult the game is, basically. In order to reduce stigma from the discount window, I mean, the point was that any bank that went to the discount window was thought to be weak and therefore everyone better avoid it. They had to think of new facilities. Conflict with the partial deposit insurance we talked about. You had to generate international lender of last resort that hadn't really been done before. What you'll be aware of, the cross-currency swap arrangements so that US dollar funding could be made available to European banks, for example. So much more need to cooperate between the central banks. Fortunately, no major cross-border failure. Although even in that period, yeah, it was mainly in the layman's period, I suppose. And if we hadn't had the systemic period already, there was concern about exit strategies. And that's the big issue now. How do you get out of this? Keeping everybody afloat situation. Okay, what about the systemic period since Lehman's? Basically, the big change is that the fiscal authorities have ridden into the rescue at a huge cost to themselves and all of the rest of us. I notice you Estonians don't have big fiscal debts, but I know I do. So, what has happened? How have the fiscal authorities come in? And what I'm going to argue is that the non-systemic period was the more innovative period. The non-systemic period was the time when various kinds of new lender of last resort were devised. In the systemic period, it's been more according to the book what's really happened. You know, you can read it in Holscher and Quinton. It's very much what they recommended, most of it. So firstly, we've had recapitalization of banks. In the US, for example, I've got a figure of $198 billion that the US government has spent already on recapitalizing banks. Similar figures elsewhere. A particular UK feature was overriding the merger policy, which is that Lloyds were allowed to buy HBOS, although it generated a bank that was dominating the banking system because the government was so scared that HBOS would collapse and they wouldn't be able to hold the system at all after that. So they overrode the merger policy, and the commission is now looking into that and might want to unwind it. We'll see. Extension of deposit insurance. We talked earlier about getting rid of co-insurance, but it was much wider than that. In most countries, it rose, the amount of deposit insurance. And in Ireland, for example, it was all assets were covered. Governments went around purchasing illiquid or impaired assets. They also guaranteed loans. They guaranteed funding, they guaranteed asset-backed securities, they guaranteed anything that moved. In the US, they guaranteed money market funds. And these are just some rough numbers. Total outlays, GDP, 6% of GDP, but total support is as much as 50% of GDP. Now, the trouble with numbers like that is they sound scary. But they're probably not realistic. I think the eventual number will be between those two. The point is that 50% of GDP includes all the guarantees, and the guarantees are not all going to be called by any means. Those are calming devices, right? But it could easily be well in the teens, I think, of GDP, what it costs. The central banks have been relieved at the fiscal authorities moving in, because they couldn't have sorted the post-Lehman's problem themselves, obviously. On the other hand, we've seen a huge growth of the balance sheets in the UK and US, 15% of GDP. And this is basically taking over the interbank markets functions. They're just running, they're providing liquidity to whoever needs it. Further innovations, types of collateral, cross-border swap lines have been developed. UK have developed new standing facilities they didn't have before, which was trying to overcome the stigma problem that Northern Rock had shown. And as I said earlier, they revealed massive clandestine support for major banks of £62 billion back in October, which is classical lender of last resort. The US, I think, was the most interesting player in the post-Lehman's period, because it wasn't just the Treasury, it was also the Fed who got into new areas of support. Basically, what the Fed was doing was providing funds to borrowers and investors in markets, and not just intermediaries. They were doing market maker of last resort as well, or even investor of last resort, I think one can argue. And that included, for example, supporting commercial paper, what's called the CPFF program, supporting other short-term assets via what's called the term auction program, mortgage-backed securities, long-term liquidity support, which was called the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility. A nice paper to look at, which I'll show you in a minute, is the Bank of England's paper on macroprudential surveillance. We'll come back to that in a minute. They purchased the obligations of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They also helped the Treasury support money funds and supporting major institutions with loans as well, as the Treasury giving them capital. So the Fed got into many things, and that's been perhaps a lot more innovative than the Bank of England and the Eurozone, although some of these features were also emulated in UK and Eurozone as well. Question whether laymans would have been rescued. There was a change of the law just after it, which might have enabled that to happen. A more monetary policy aspect that's really relevant is not so much lender of last resort, is the quantitative easing, whereby in the UK, the UK Bank of England is buying assets in order to increase the money supply in line with the monetarist view of financial instability. But as I say, on balance, I think it's a classical response to a systemic crisis. The US is the main innovator in that area. So let's summarise this final lecture of the day. I'm arguing the subprime crisis is the most serious crisis since the 30s, with a number of novel features, but I think it validates the traditional theory, as well as the incentive mechanisms, so we can trace back the validity of some of the analysis we've talked about earlier in the day. So it emphasises this need to look for vulnerabilities. The second row of the table, right, is the one to look for. It showed that the liquidity risk assessment in particular has to be rethought. And more generally, liquidity policy has got to be rethought. I think that's really the biggest lesson. The market liquidity versus funding risk is one aspect, but it's more generally the maturity mismatch needs to be thought of. Lender of last resort challenges, longer term provision, lower quality collateral, investment banks, confidentiality, deposit insurance, all the sorts of features we've talked about. And, you know, how much moral hazard are we going to end up with now this is all finished is an interesting question. I think we can argue that innovation's been mainly in the non-systemic period, but now the issue is the exit strategy. How do we get out of this situation? And how do we reform liquidity regulation? So, let me just, those are the references. The two papers there that I mentioned are on your links. Let me just show you briefly, that's the W. Bush thing. I can just get hold of this Bank of England thing, because there's a couple of nice illustrations of what we've been talking about. Financial stability. Yeah, this is the thing that I'm talking about, the thing called the role of macroprudential policy, and it's a topic I'll talk about tomorrow, but there's just a couple of nice things in here that you might want to see. Okay, so yeah, this was just issued, the role of macroprudential policy, and let's just, can we get full screen? Yeah, I think you're probably right, it's you're probably right. Okay, So this is long-term capital ratios going back to the 19th century, admittedly. But what it shows is how capital adequacy, despite Basel, has still, in the end, ended up quite low. And it's interesting that what is the blue line? Blue line should be the UK, I think. But anyway, it shows you that capital adequacy has been on a downtrend. And then this is this liquidity chart I was showing you. I don't know if you can see from the back, but basically in 1968, we're not talking long ago, we had 15 to 30% liquidity on banks' balance sheets. And in 2007, we had 1% if we were lucky. So this is my case and the Bank of England's case as well. But basically, everybody forgot about liquidity, at least on the asset side. What we've also got here, let's just see.
or maybe we don't. No, maybe it's, maybe I've got a, another one in mind. I thought we had a summary of the various ways in which the crisis has been counteracted. Oh, there we are. Oh no, that's lessons from past crises. No, never mind. Yeah, so anyway, that's something well worth reading. Okay, any questions? Or is it the end of the day? Right. You want to say anything?
If it starts tomorrow, I'll play again.
Yeah. I look forward to seeing you.